Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm guest host Stacey Waite, and my guest tonight is the poet Jennifer Perrine. Jennifer Perrine's first book of poetry, The Body is No Machine, was published by New Issues in 2007 and won the 2008 Devil's Kitchen Reading Award. Her recent poems have won the 2008 Ledge Poetry Award, the Black Warrior Review 4th Annual Poetry Contest, and the Virginia Arts of the Book Center Taste Test. She lives in Des Moines, Iowa, where she runs the Drake University Writers and Critics Series and teaches courses in creative writing, queer literature and theories, and women's studies. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. You're going to read us some poems from The Body is No Machine?
Great. I'd like to start with this first poem called Pica, which is a disorder, a bodily illness in which a person is compelled to eat non-food items like dirt and the contents of ashtrays, weird sorts of things like that. So this is Pica. This is how clay becomes flesh, dirt and grit clumping with saliva, bits of sand wedged between gum and tooth. In my mother's mouth, her palate alive with humus, a crush of chalk threading down her throat, and somewhere deep within her gut, a galatea, milk-white, translucent, a creature she'll bring together from pulverized stone. She's sure all desire begins with me, my unborn, indiscriminate taste, my unwieldy appetite for handfuls of ash and soil. And when I'm born, though she gives me a name plain and util as toothpaste, she insists on calling me magpie, and how she's right. When I'm first caught filling my cavernous maw with paint chips, plaster, coffee grounds pulled from the trash, my father reassures her, this is the work of all infants, to hold the world inside them piece by piece, to turn each sliver about on the tongue, a shape in a tantrum, a code the child's mouth cracks. But when my mother finds me, years later, a toddler plucking flies from the window, the curse slithers out of her, freak, as though she's never enjoyed this comfort, as though she doesn't remember reaching for more. To my cannibalized twin, whatever you were or might have been, orb, lump, dim glow beside me, some human shard of glitter, pearled sand in our mother's paunch. I tell you now you were lucky, uncaged by my misfit hunger. You can regard it a kindness. My desire to absorb has always been here, waiting to get drunk on the next heart, imbibe a look through veiled eyes, suck the tongue of somebody's pigtailed beloved. Tell me, stranger, lonely monk hovering somewhere in my cells, engaged in whatever thankless task my young greed assigned you, if you were here, could you staunch this wanting, make me cough up its sharp seed? Coveting with pronunciation guide. And what if I said your breasts rise like an umlaut over the O of your stomach? That I have imagined two hip bones, grave and acute, inflecting legs long as vowels, O's and oos, the tendons at the backs of your knees taut as macrons. Who else will tell you how your top lip lurks over your teeth like a tilde, the small list of your smirk to the left? Let me whisper you seduction like a sedia, soft and complex, an arcing voice full of hooks and barbs. Let me rest the circumflex of my hands, tented, tentative, against your waist. Let my body be a breve, the cup into which you drop your breath. Let desire be clumsy as a schwa, upside down, almost soundless. my first stripper, was named Robin, and yes, her breasts were red as she winnowed the weeds from her garden. She was the kind of woman my mother always warned me about. Don't you go near that apartment downstairs. But how could I have resisted the daggers, those bright blades that slipped from the hem of her shorts, their ink climbing into the sun, trying to touch the grass where she knelt? As I remember, only her face escaped the stained glass trail of tattoos. The dueling hummingbirds with intercrossed proboscises flanking the straight stretch of her spine, a pair of dice perched on her sternum, the haloed virgin competing with Lucky Seven for the privacy where her neck was cloaked by hair. Still too young to imagine her swirling in soft purple light, ballasted by a metal pole. When my mother hissed, "Stripper," I could only envision this. Robin running her hands along her legs as if to remove stockings. And under her fingers, a unicorn skitters down to the ground. Poker chips pool around her ankles. Birds lift into the air, colors flung like parachutists, humming with light.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Stacey Waite, and my guest tonight is the poet Jennifer Perrine, reading from her collection of poems, The Body is No Machine. I was really interested in, as you were reading, one of the things that keeps coming up over and over again is this notion of ingestion or hunger or wanting, and it's interesting to watch the way the wanting sort of takes shape, and sometimes it's dangerous or perceived as dangerous. Sometimes it's sort of celebratory. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, in the writing of the poems, how much you're aware of that movement of desire, if that's something that comes up as a result of poetry for you.
I think in some cases I'm very aware of the dangers of desire as I'm writing the poems. For instance, in the To My Cannibalized Twin, that one's explicitly, for me, it was a way of working through the sense that desire is sometimes all-consuming and that others can be harmed in the process. In this case, it's using, you know, the metaphor of this invented twin I've created for myself, that I've ingested them completely through my own desire. And that comes up in Pike as well, where created this disease for, or I haven't created the disease, but put this disease onto myself or a persona of myself where I am just consuming and consuming. And so there's this question of at what point is desire too much? At what point is it harmful? But I think in maybe the last two poems that I read, it's something that's moving beyond those questions into how can I represent desire in a way that's not about consuming somebody else, but praising someone else, or just giving the desire back to them in a way where they hold the power, where they can use it in the way that they want to.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like in some of the, I guess what I was calling ingestion, like once the desire is had or ingestion's had, there's kind of this transformation, right? So I think that's really interesting throughout the work too, and something thematically that seemed to be in the poems you read, at least.
Yeah, and in the poem about the twin, there's the sense that you know, through ingestion, that twin becomes part of the speaker of that poem, and it's there always. And I think, you know, if we want to broaden it out to bigger things, I mean, when we desire someone, we take a part of that aspect, whatever it is we desire about that person or that thing, into ourselves, and that thing carries with us long after that person, you know, may be gone from our lives.
Yeah. Will you read us some more poems?
Sure. This is a poem called Gender Question Number 2, and The gender question number one that I've never written a poem for was based off of a website that it's sort of the predecessor to Facebook, where one of the questions that you have to answer on this sort of old social networking site was, you know, your gender question was just male, female, or I think it had an other option. So it was trying to be progressive, but I felt like it failed to ask all of the questions. And so the second question was gender question number two, butch, femme, androgynous, or all over the map. Marking the small check in the small box, I think there is no appropriate answer here, except perhaps artichoke. Impenetrable, thick-petaled flower, sharp edge and ragged root. Inside, velvet opal translucent tongues, and inside, further still, the choke, silky threads who want to hold in the heart, to raise a spired fortress for the tender green. This, though, is not an option, so I choose all over the map. All over Barbados, Siam, Constantinople, all over Ireland and Israel, all over the Sierra of my stomach, down the straits of my legs, to the archipelago of toes. Somewhere on the circuit I stop to visit whatever terrain bears the name femme, some scenic dream atop a mountain or nestled deep within a delta. I watch tourists team around the attractions. I snap some shots too, so I'll remember what femme looks like once I leave. Perhaps from there I'll bike to Butch, a city that sparkles like hubcaps spun from a swift machine. Some say that there the stars are drilled through sheets of obsidian, pressed like grommets into hides of darkest leather. If the iron gates to town are barred, I'll fly first class to Androgynous, where blades of grass glow silver, the shade of Joan of Arc's sword, and the sky at sunset runs red as the rouge on Bowie's cheeks. The land shifts, rolls and recedes like the tide, carries me out and out to my home, my artichoke home, my platypus home, my webbed feet and beak and fur. I trace again my small mark in my small box, my small window from which I watch landscapes reach like frail fingers into space, into the places we have not named. Buzz. My first time was in some rinky-dink barbershop in Boston's South End, my head shorn clean by a toothless man who smelled of cherry tobacco and Barbasol, who nattered on about how it just doesn't look right on a girl. Later, for my parents, I'd say this was a practical act, an evasion of catcalls and the wind that whipped my hair into a knotted net while I walked to class. Not quite a lie, but the more clandestine truth was Sue, my freshman roommate, who wore a purple tux to class, made friends on the subway, introduced me most mornings to the guy she'd picked up the night before, his name always sweet and strange. Flower, perhaps, or moo. She kept bottles of fungi in the mini fridge and during finals took ecstasy with her friend Goat, then slept for 3 days while I wrote her paper on mysticism. Sue shaved her head over winter break and returned, stubble abuzz with blonde and blue streaks, gleaming as if she'd been consecrated, a Byzantine Madonna, her nimbus bright, a jug of vodka cradled like an infant. And when she hugged me, I rubbed her smooth crown like the belly of some golden statue, that touch a prayer. Because you're no magician. I'm surprised when you offer to cut me in two. No glittered assistant would trust you with a saw. I mean the way you touch me before you leave, unfurling your fingers, a length of scarves falling from your sleeve onto the drinkable part of my throat, or how you speak in your sleep in words secret as Latin, the hocus-pocus mystique of your somniloquy leaking into the dark. I want my doves tucked away in their compartment, safe from the tug of your gloves and the tip of your hat, the ledger domain that lets you vanish at will, shedding your trail of open-mouthed awe and licorice smoke, and reappear when your audience thinks you've gone for good, tossing off your cape and waving your wand.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Stacey Waite, and my guest tonight is the poet Jennifer Perrine, reading from her book, The Body is No Machine. One of the things I noticed in those last group of poems you just read is the references to naming. So, and also earlier, you talked about that poem of your mother calling you Magpie rather than Jennifer, which is
Which is plain and utilis toothpaste. Right, I'm sorry name. For anybody who's named Jennifer is listening to this.
And then at the end of the gender question poem, you talk about these places we have not yet named. And I was wondering if sort of if that's part of the political something you think is your political project as something you take on as a poet, is that idea of naming.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those things that that poetry is especially good at for, in my life at least, in my both reading and writing of poetry, that it's given me so many names for things that I didn't have language for before. And so when I do things like write poems like this gender question number two, where I take these questions like where we're only given these very limited options for defining, say, our gender identity. And then I make up things like, well, my gender identity is going to be artichoke because because it's way more appropriate than butch or femme or any or male or female or any of these other things that we might have. So it certainly has a political context to it, because when we find when we say that, you know, making up our own names for ourselves or are a legitimate means of making sense of our identity or our place in the world, I think there's always a political aspect to that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess then if we are able to make up our own names, then it's also our own job to drop them, change them, and revise them.
Right, yeah.
Like
exactly.
A poem whenever we'd want to.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's really wonderful, the way that the poem sort of becomes then the metaphor for gender, where it's just, it's able to move. The poem is able to name and rename and revise just like selves are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it seems to be a theme in the work of like identity and this revisiting of the self and the body and trying to make some sense of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if I found one good name that would embody whatever aspect of identity, whether it's gender or race or any of these other things, sexuality, that if I could find one good name and be happy with it, then I would stop writing. But I'm never going to find that one word that's going to embody all of these complexities and changes that happen. So
I don't know if you've gotten this one before, but why artichoke? I mean, in that poem, like what draws you to that artichoke? I'm really interested in that.
Well, part of it is that artichokes were something that I ate a lot as a child, which strikes me as a little bit weird reflecting back on it now. But my mother grew up in California, and where there were a lot of artichokes, and so it was something that was part of her diet. And so the practice of eating them, the attention, the focus on the act of eating itself, where you have to peel each of these sort of leaves off and you scrape your teeth along it, and then you have to work around the choke. The whole process is so involved and intricate that I thought the complexity of that is something that I want to get at in terms of the complexity of any kind of identity I want to have. I want it to have that kind of complexity.
Wow. I hadn't thought of that an artichoke, is very much a process. So it's something always like in process when you try to eat it. That's fascinating. Can you read us some more poems?
Sure. This is kind of a depressing poem, just as a warning. Elegy for Mrs. Donnell. What I remember most is not her Scottish brogue, the tough gust of her tongue, but the way she dragged me down the hallway, how heat ran crimson from my pinched right ear into my cheeks. Her thick missile fingers clamped on me while smoke froze to my lips, while quick-eyed girls thrust their hands under faucets, swallowed their proof down a mouth of dark drain. What I remember, too, are her eyes, silver snares, the sinister click-clack snick of her dentures. She said I'd amount to less than my mother had, less than my sister, too. She said that fifth graders who cut became teens who dropped out. How was I to know then, when I wished her dead, that her husband was slowly carrying out the job, that soon he'd take a brick to her head? How was I to know what she knew about being caught? The amputation of my brother's finger proves that some body parts are worth more than others. At birth, his left index finger, clinging like a remora to his thumb, the thin slip of tissue binding the two slit open, severed to save that opposable digit. What remains besides is the knuckle, its crayon pink hump gleaming amidst his ochre skin, that anomalous smoothness somehow wondrous, the tonsure of a monk, the silk inside one's cheek. As for legacy, he recalls once receiving detention for pointing with his middle finger, and later restringing a bass, his right hand free to work the frets. Still, he's never felt phantom pain. No memory of sense flickers in his cells. And when he tries to imagine his hand whole, he says it's never quite right, the forefinger always more luminous or supple than the others, its surface waxy as an ex voto hanging limply on the wall of some sanctuary, as if it was never his at all, this body made to be offered up. For my brother who cannot cry. Holding you down, my knees like needles, their bone-sharp weight against your spindly arms, I pried open your eyelids, watching them part like lips that want to hold in their world. In this world, you never held still long enough for me to put in the drops, and sometimes you fought me so hard the record would skip on the turntable, its stuttering drowned out by your wailing, the screams that forced snot to bubble and bead on your upper lip. I think of this now, the way you screamed, not so much the sound but the great, frightened gape, the way your baby teeth shone like hard milk against the pinkish dark, the way your lips cracked and bled, stretched to let out what you could not say.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Stacey Waite, and my guest tonight is the poet Jennifer Perrine, reading from her book, The Body is No Machine. Those last few poems you were reading about your brother, the amputated finger, and the inability to produce tears. And I was wondering, thinking about the title, The Body is No Machine, if you see the book as exposing the limits of the body, or maybe even resisting the limits of the body, or what the body can or cannot do.
Yeah, the title was maybe a little bit bolder of a statement than I intended to be when I first wrote it. But a couple of people have asked me, is it some sort of critique of the Cartesian model of the mind body split, which I guess it is in a way that Descartes, has this sense of the body, and most of Western tradition has followed it since, that the body is a machine and it's just there to serve the higher function of our, our brains, our minds, all of our intellectual capacity. And I think these poems that talk about, the body in crisis in some way, where it's not able to do the thing that we think it's naturally supposed to do, or where in in the amputation poem, where the body is born in a way that we don't that is somehow considered abnormal, and so it needs to be fixed or changed. That all of those things, I think I write about them to remind us that our bodies are who we are, and that there isn't this division of how we think about ourselves or how we think about the world from our body, that our body is the only way that we come to know the world is through our senses. And so I sort of obsessively write about these different bodily actions to try to grapple with that a bit.
Will you read us just a couple more poems?
Sure. The Weight. Inexplicable, the way the ham resting its haunches in pineapple stew has prompted my father to resurrect the weekend work of his youth, the days when to be a man meant knowing how best to slaughter a pig. Between forkfuls and careful napkin swipes, my father pulls his mustache the way he does when he's nervous. And it must be memory that makes him nervous now, as he softly suggests that the challenge was the catch, the struggle to hold, then one swift mallet stroke with the weight of the body behind it. Inexplicable, too, how his story conjures my own youth, shot through with breakneck light, the reckless speed of nights like the one when, leaving late for some party, some date, I backed his car into the mailbox at the end of the drive. I never made it out that night, though my father never said a word as he hefted the mailbox like a monstrous hammer, carried it inside, its head bumping against the burdened curve of his shoulder, its door yawning like a tired child. Ballad for a Goth Chick. When Mary first saw death, he had one arm slung over her best friend's shoulder. Mary could see how Susan had fallen for someone like death, the older man, confident and debonair, who left teenage Susan gasping for breath the way none of her gangly classmates could. She was captivated by death, and when he finally left her, Susan never quite returned to normal. Mary scarcely cared. She flirted with death, though he wasn't into formal relationships. Death was sexy. He could have any woman he wanted, or man for that matter. So Mary dressed for death. Her short black sheath flaunted the legs she wrapped in tall boots and fishnets that whispered and sighed as she walked. She wanted death to notice, willed his eyes to follow her the way hers stalked him. Sometimes death filled Mary's thoughts, and when she lay in bed, night dragging dark skirts across the sky, she imagined him shifting against her sheets, the arc of his back pale as the moonlit surface of the lake where she sometimes played at suicide, wading in until her head vanished. It was death that made her writhe up for air. After all, what if death came for her? What if today Mary would lean into his kiss at last, death bending to meet her halfway?
The poetry of Jennifer Perrine. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody 91.3 WYEP.